Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I am once again Josh Pleister, lead writer for Game Wisdom, and joining me is my co-host, the site's designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey, guys.
Well, this has definitely been an exciting week for Game Wisdom. We got our first guest post, and not only that, but this was done by the lead designer of the City Builder series, Chris Beatrice. Now, the City Builders have been around since the 90s, and I know that Kent isn't too familiar with them.
Yeah, it was never really a genre I was into.
But he did like one game from Chris Beatrice.
Oh, yeah, Lords of Magic. It would be great to bring him into the podcast to kind of grill him, asking questions about that game and, you know, and for Josh to talk to him about the City Builder games also.
Yeah, man. Ironically, Lords of Magic is one of the games I haven't played yet.
Yeah, we haven't flipped here, but I've only played Lords of Magic, and he's played all the City Builder games.
Yeah. So for those of you who did not read the article yet, he wrote about the Walker system. Now, has always been a point of contention for City Builder fans. Effectively, the Walker system was used as a way to supply your city with goods and services. What happened was whenever you placed down a service building, a person would pop out of it, like a doctor or a tax collector. And whatever structures that person passed would get that service. So the point of contention that a lot of people had was that it's not really realistic. It's more gamey, and that's not how it works in real life. Mm-hmm. So for the post, Chris talked about the push versus pull system for city builders. The push system refers to either radius systems, where you place a building down that has an area of effect, or the old walker system from the Impressions error. The push system refers to the services would come out or push out from those buildings to affect your people. While a pull system is when the citizens themselves come out of their homes to visit your service buildings.
Alright. So what's the benefit for the two systems? What's the most used, you would say?
The push system It was more widely used back in the 90s with SimCity, the Impressions Error, those types of games. And recently, pool systems have found their ways into more, I guess, unique city builders. So, like Children of the Nile, which was one of the games Chris did for his company, Tilted Mill.
That was his first release, right?
Yes, the first release from Tilted Mill. The advantage of the push system, the main one, was that it made the information very apparent to the person playing. You can see very easily what houses have what, where people are going, and you were able to design and build your city up from that information. The advantage of the pull system was that, one, it was more realistic. You actually have people going to your various stores, to your various buildings for services. And that it worked well when you had small numbers of people, not like 10,000, 20,000. Because if you did, it would basically just wreck your game engine. Because how could it really show 10,000 people wandering the streets looking for goods?
Don't forget, it would be extremely hard to decipher who's who with such a mass of numbers of people.
And in the article, he basically talked about his own thoughts from spending almost two decades designing games using these systems. And it really is a fascinating read for people who love the genre or who want a deeper insight. So definitely check it out.
Right. I mean, he's talking about not just, you know, gameplay and interesting concepts for designers, but simulation and realistic simulation and those best methods of going about that.
And for those of you interested in his new game, Medieval Mayor, he also briefly talked about how these two systems are going to be applied to that game. Alright, so let's move on and talk about some news this week. The piece I want to talk about is the Humble Bundle controversy. For those of you who aren't familiar, the Humble Bundle is a recent service that served two purposes. One, they wanted to promote indie developers who may not have gotten so much time in the limelight before. And two, they wanted to raise money for charity like Child's Play and the American Red Cross. So what happened was that this week, instead of spotlighting indie developers, they did a Humble THQ bundle showing nothing but games from THQ. And as we know, THQ is a major publisher. Now, they have been falling on hard times lately.
Yeah, maybe so, that's why. They're like, oh, you need money. This is the only way.
Yeah. And the problem is that this particular bundle really betrayed a lot of the tenets of previous bundles.
I mean, look at the name. Humble Bundle. Is THQ humble? Are they an independent developer? Do they need the exposure? No. That's the outrage.
And it gets better than that. Normally with the Humble Bundle, you receive keys for the game, for whatever games you want, for whatever platform. So if you want a Steam key, if you want just a regular retail key so you don't have to worry about downloading any services, you can do that. But with this bundle, you can only get them with Steam keys. And that limits the marketability of the bundle compared to previous ones.
All right, so they're forcing DRM on you. Even though everyone loves Steam, it's still DRM.
True. And I know that there are plenty of people out there who prefer just to download the game and keep it on their hard drive and not have to worry about that stuff. And that was one of the key benefits of the Humble Bundle, was that you had that freedom of choice. And to make things even worse, this bundle, you were only given Windows keys, not Mac or Linux options.
Yeah, actually, I knew one of the developers that was in a Humble Bundle. They made Jamestown.
Mm-hmm.
They were called Final Form Games. They're located in Philadelphia. Great game, by the way. You guys should try it out.
Yeah.
Well, I heard that they had to create a Linux version of it, too, along with their normal version. So they made their own custom engine. So it's actually very difficult to port over and cost them a good amount of time. So, you know, it kind of, again, that's another betrayal, you know, limiting the viewership or an audience to your games.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, if you look on the Humble Bundle website, it shows who the top contributors are. And a few of the people on there are actually members of THQ, including Jason Rubin, who I think he's the current president of THQ. I'm not entirely sure about that.
So it kind of feels like what happens when you see indie developers get corporate sponsorship. It feels like a giant betrayal, you know? Or it feels like an artist sellout.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people are like, you know, grinding their teeth over.
Yeah, and the fact that the bundle from the inception was supposed to be this thing for independent developers, a way to get guys who don't have millions of dollars of advertising, you know, the recognition and a chance in the spotlight to sell games that would be unique but otherwise unappreciated. And making what even sucks more is that a lot of the games on the bundle aren't really, like, that new or that interesting. I know that Saints Row the Third is obviously a good pick, but they chose Red Faction Armageddon and not the most considered the superior game, Red Faction Guerrilla.
And don't forget, they also added you get free DLC if you pay over the average for Armageddon. And I think, but they did offer Titan Quest with that too.
Yeah, but it doesn't come with the expansion.
What?
Oh, yeah.
All right, nice. those evil bastards. But yeah, I think that this is definitely the wrong direction, because what's happening now is they're ruining the credibility. And when their credibility is ruined, the Humble Bundle starts to fail.
Yeah, and it has been a really good service. Now I know that some people have been, you know, saying, you know, what's the big deal? But I think this does set precedent for what the Humble Bundle was supposed to represent. And it definitely sucks that it's, while it's good for THQ, they're getting a lot of money. It sort of, I think it's backfiring for the Humble Bundle.
Right, and that's what happens to sellouts, you know? First you're doing pretty well, but then, you know, your original audience gets, you know, displaced somewhere else. Because they obviously do not want to get user services to listen to your music anymore. You change. You change, man.
And I think in this current economy, you've got to keep your customers happy. You can't, you know, betray their trust because they're just going to go somewhere else. And I know that besides Humble Bundle, Good Old Games also does a good job of selling their games without any copy protection. You buy the game and then it's yours for whatever you want to do with it. Just download it and you don't need to worry about DRM or anything like that. And Good Old Games have expanded this year for newer titles and not just, you know, older games from the 80s and 90s. So they have become a viable store for digital retailers.
Well, yeah. Also, yeah. Doesn't Good Old Games have Chris's games also? Where are they? Just so the audience knows.
Yeah, they do. They have currently Zeus and Pharaoh, which are considered two of the highlights of the Impressions City Builder genre. All right, so what news do you have to share with us this week, Kenneth?
I don't have too many, but I think we can discuss, you know, the decline of sales for games in general. So it looks like, at least to this Gamma Sutra article, that sales have been down nearly 11% from last year, which is pretty huge. As an analyst said, it was only going to be about 2%. And, you know, this is probably because of the failings of Call of Duty Black Ops 2. It seems that Black Ops 1 is probably going to be the maybe in the pinnacle of the Call of Duty franchise in terms of sales. So it losing so much has definitely created a decline. And we've seen a lot of very large games come out. Halo 4, Assassin's Creed 3, and sales are still down for the last few months.
And also with that, according to Gamasutra.com, right now, Black Ops 2 for Xbox 360 and PS3 sales is at 7.4 million copies sold, while Modern Warfare 3 from last year was at 8.8 million copies sold. So there's definitely a decline there in terms of Black Ops profitability.
Well, yeah, and they didn't even release the Wii U numbers, and I heard those were abysmal. But that's just a rumor. We have no official statement. But I believe, the only reason I say that one's abysmal without knowing the exact numbers is because I believe all the sales of the games were abysmal in comparison to Mario. That was the only one that sold well in comparison. Even with this launch, it was supposed to stem the decline, but it hasn't really done that. The decline is still there.
Yeah. And the Wii U, really, other than Mario, didn't have a killer app. I have heard some people say Zombie U was okay, but it's only been like a few okays in a sea of, you know, poor to bad reviews.
I heard Scribblenauts was good, but I don't think it sold well. But yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe because of like lack of new IPs, because all of these are sequels. You know, Call of Duty Black Ops 2, just calling it Black Ops 2. Shows how much effort you put into the naming convention or how much you revamped it, even though I heard the reviews are better than the first one. And then Halo 4, I mean, it's a 4, and Assassin's Creed 3. Even though I liked Assassin's Creed 3, you know, it's still a sequel. So we need some more original IPs coming out.
Yeah, and what has gotten some buzz this year was Dishonored by Arkane Studios. And published by Bethesda Softworks. That, I think, is one of the few original IPs that actually has done well enough to, they now talk about expanding it into a franchise.
Well, good. I think that it was a very good game. It just had a bunch of very odd bugs to it. And a lack of, it had a very short campaign, I heard.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this was definitely the year of sequels. Diablo.
I think they say that about every medium. You think about movies too. It's like, oh, it's a year of sequels. But then again, it's very hard to create a new IP. So it's
true.
And especially because the cost is so high now, which is why the indie developers are so important, because their costs are low and they can still make a high profit. And it gives gamers more options, especially creative options too, for yeah. where they spend their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I've been playing Faster Than Light, Hotline Miami, Marvel the Ninja, three independent games that are just completely different from each other and great titles.
Definitely. And I just bought FTL and Hotline Miami. They're on sale. Ta-da.
On Steam.
Yeah, check it out. Check it out for sure. Both of them have qualities that were very addictive from what I hear and fast paced. So I'm going to love to try them out in the next couple of days. Oh, and as for this whole decline, I think it's probably also connected to online digital distribution. I'm sure that has part of the hardware declines, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Because times always change, and you have to kind of just go with it. I know, again, this is just speculation. I don't know any of the actual numbers, but that's my assumption and my guess of yeah. why it's in decline, a part of the reason why it's in decline.
Yeah,
but I think the real reason is lack of originality.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I think that's hurting it are game sales. It's becoming less and less viable to buy games brand new at launch when you can maybe wait a month or two and get them from anywhere from 25% to half off. Right. And we just had Steam's big Thanksgiving sale, and now, of course, at the end of the month, we're going to have their holiday sale. And we've had a few big games come out since then, like Far Cry 3, and who knows if that's going to be a big sale in a few weeks.
Right, and like example, The Darkness 2, when it came out, the only reason I didn't buy it right away, because I really dig the style and the music, but the reason I didn't buy it right away was $60. I heard it was a 6-hour campaign or less. I'm like, oh, I don't really want to spend $10 an hour on that game.
Yeah.
And then eventually I waited just like 2 months and the Steam sale can't hit and it was only $12. I'm like, bam, yes. I'll take
it. For even cheaper, I got it for $5 from, it was an Amazon sale.
Right. And I only feel bad if the game is excellent. Like, I feel bad buying Batman Arkham Asylum, Arkham City, and Deus Ex, but those were great games, so I don't regret it too much. Because there's just some games where you just want to play it right away, and those were two that I definitely spent full top dollar for.
Yeah. And I know this year the two games that I basically bought for day one were Borderlands 2 and XCOM Ending Unknown.
Both excellent games, by the way. I loved XCOM.
But even then, I didn't pay full price for them, which I think it was $60 for Borderlands, $50 for XCOM. I got them both for sale on greenmangaming.com.
Oh yeah, I got XCOM, you gave me the same deal. You know, so yeah, I used that same promo.
Yeah, so it just doesn't seem that reasonable to spend $60 for a brand new game. Especially how you were talking about with The Darkness 2. It was only like a 6-hour campaign. So why should someone spend $60 for that 6 hours of content?
I guess that's up to the marketers to try to convince us. Okay. Or for the developers to put in enough content or interesting systems to make us interested in the product. Enough to invest $60.
Or they have to figure out a way to cut costs somewhere and maybe lower the price of retail games. But we've been, you know, talking about that for years and it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and digital distribution too cuts a lot of costs out. But, you know, the cost is still high because I think, you know, they put a lot of money into marketing. A ton of it. Like, I remember there was a game, well, I forget exactly the game's name, but it had $200 million in marketing and the game only cost like $50 million to make.
Mm.
And I was like, that's insane. And I think it was because it was a new IP. Now, if anyone knows, please make comment.
And I don't think marketing isn't that important these days compared to 10 years ago, thanks to, you know, more internet sites, word of mouth, and even just getting your game on Steam in the first place can be marketing enough. I've heard lots of stories from indie developers who found massive profit from when their games finally got on Steam or were part of a Steam sale, and they had zero advertising before then.
Right, and again, a lot of this cost too, at least the demands of the cost, seem a bit excessive, especially for marketing and, you know, making all these games have to include multiplayer. It's another one too. So much development cost goes into that. And it's trash in the end of the day anyways. Because eventually your audience will move on.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about what's usually the scapegoat, piracy? Do you think that that's having any big effect on publishers?
Sure, definitely. But they're offering draconian systems with their DRM, like having me to use Origin, having me to use Uplay. Like, every time I play Far Cry 3, I have to start with Uplay first. And it's just, that's two systems of DRM right there. The bot on Steam, and then have to run it through Steam and Uplay. And I know somebody that pirated before it even came out. And I'm like, first of all, I find that highly unethical. Because it is, I mean, I'm in the field of game development. I want to respect my peers. But, you know, he's playing it before its launch, before I could even play it. And he doesn't have to use the Uplay system or Steam. I'm like, that's crazy.
I know.
So again, it's sometimes the game companies, you know, they hinder their actual consumers over the pirates. Mm-hmm. Because come on, how the hell did it circumvent both Uplay and Steam? And it plays before it even gets launched.
Yeah. I had a friend like that too a few years ago who would just pirate every game. They didn't really care. And of course, he didn't have to worry about DRM or issues like that. And it does make you question, you know, why are consumers putting up with that? And why are they being saddled with these issues when someone who plays a game illegally can avoid all that hassle?
Listen, I bought Dead Rising 2, and I had to make an Xbox Live account or something. Some sort of, or Xbox On Game, whatever. I had to make an account for that.
Just Windows Live.
That one. I had to make one just to play Dead Rising. Like, good God, why? It's just, no one wants to have to sign up for multiple accounts, because all it is used to spam your email account anyways. I'm like, don't want this.
Mm-hmm. And it's only going to get worse, I think, as more publishers and console makers are coming up with like more ways to tie accounts to things, like have games with Windows Live, your Xbox, WiiWare account, PSN, and who knows what's going to happen next generation.
Well, you already can start to see it now. Look at the Wii U. Like, I believe you can only play, okay, with the Wii U, you only can play your games on your account is tied to your system. That's it. That's what it is. Your account is tied to your system. So you can't log in on other people's Wiis or whatever with your account. So you're pretty much stuck there. So if you're, for some reason, your account and all your games get messed up or something, it's lost to the ether.
Or your system breaks down.
It's, again, your account's lost to the ether.
And with the PlayStation 4 rumored, or the rumored Xbox 720, who knows what they're going to do to both, you know, stop piracy as well as, you know, downplay used games.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's some really bad PR right there. Even tossing the idea that you can't play a used game on your system, because you wreck up, not just, I mean, not like GameStop really needs the money or whatever, but what I'm saying is you're hurting your consumers again by limiting how they play these games and what money goes to developers. But then again, the reason why they don't want used games being sold is because GameStop pockets all that money and it doesn't go to developers at all. Mm-hmm. So that's why they start using, you know, these game passes and keys and codes for brand new games. Mm-hmm. At least that's their excuse, but it's being abused again.
True.
By making people buy the game twice. Go ahead.
And this year there is a ruling by the European Union on that very issue, and they ruled in favor of the consumer in what's considered the first sale doctrine. Basically, the publisher or developer are only allowed to profit from the first sale of a digital product. After that, the consumer has the freedom to do what they will, and if they want to sell it, they are allowed to profit from it.
Okay, interesting. I'd like to definitely follow how this is actually be done and how it's going to be skewered in the future, I would assume.
Yeah. All right. So, let's move on and talk about some of the games we've been playing this week. I recently played Spec Ops The Line, and this was just one just hell of a game. Not in terms of gameplay, really, but in terms of the story that it presented. The game was inspired by the book Heart of Darkness, which was the inspiration for the movie Apocalypse Now. And the game deals with a lot of complex discussions on PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, the controversy of war and what it does to a person, what's considered, you know, the right thing to do versus following orders. And the game just, really, it's just a very depressing and exhausting game, to be honest, to play because of those themes.
I'd also say it also sheds light on the commentary on how we view war games as some sort of recreation, but war isn't that, you know, arcadey or fun. It is a brutal necessity that we have in this world, in this reality.
Yeah. And the game also really does a lot to subvert your expectations of both what a military shooter can do and what is considered a game. And it's hard to talk about Spec Ops because a lot of what makes it so unique are just flat-out spoilers that would ruin it for you if you did play it. But one part of it, there's this one scene that is just the most chilling thing I've ever seen in a video game. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm just going to tell you it's in the level The Gate. And for those of you who play the game, you know what I'm talking about. And as the game goes on, what they do is it starts out as just this generic, you know, military shooter, you know, everyone's, you know, fist pumping and all that stuff.
Yeah, you have two sassy sidekicks talking to you, making stupid jokes.
And as the game goes on, things just go downhill just so much. People die, and the whole point of the game is you're supposed to be saving the people of Dubai, where the game takes place in, after this massive sandstorm.
Wait, actually, aren't you supposed to be doing recon? That was the original mission. You weren't supposed to go in, but I believe he saw a soldier being tortured, so he decided to go in, say, you know, rescue's more important than recon. However, things take a huge shift as the game progresses.
Yep, and the game just constantly calls into question the character's motives. Like, is he really doing this as a hero? Is he a villain? Is he doing more harm than good in Dubai? And the game doesn't ask him those questions, it asks you those questions. Right. And as an interesting fourth wall mechanic, the loading screens, each time you either die or move to a different level, they start out with like general, you know, generic gameplay tips, like press square to crouch or stuff like that. And then as it goes on, it starts asking these questions like, how many Americans have you killed today? Or, it's okay to kill people because this is a video game, but you don't want to do this in real life. Or, you're a good person, you're still a good person after this. Or, it's not your fault. And
that's some really messed up things to put in there.
And the ending just really just drives like the whole psychotic crazy point home and delivers just one hell of a twist that I don't think a lot of people are going to see coming. And it really speaks a lot for what the designers envisioned and developed this game. I was talking to Kenneth before the podcast and both of us are just dumbfounded as to how this game got published. For just, you know, these crazy, mature themes, and for this, you know, usually, you know, very comedic or, you know, not so serious genre.
I mean, like, listen, they do a really good job of setting it up to be a generic shooter. They have the right, they have the setting, they have the type of soldiers, they have the gameplay, all that stuff screams out generic. It pretty much set up the game to be a Medal of Honor warfighter. That's pretty much what it set it up to be. But it came out to be something extremely unique. They gave you these expectations. They set these expectations up for you. And then they just break them down piece by piece and telling you why, you know, you should feel ashamed. And I think that's great. I think it's great for them to go over this and kind of show the ridiculousness of where we've gotten to with all these different war games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is definitely not the game that's going to make you feel happy when you see the ending.
But it'll definitely make you see things in a different light, and that's good. Different perspective is great.
Mm-hmm. And it's a shame that I don't think a lot of people actually play this game, because if they did, I think we would have seen a lot more discussions, both from game sites and probably from the general news. Because this game does a lot to, I guess, like, throw mud in the face of, you know, our military, our forces. You're not fighting terrorists in Spec Ops the Line. You're majorly fighting U.S. soldiers. And not just, you know, fighting them like you shoot to stun, you shoot to kill in this game.
Right. And again, like, that's why it's even more ridiculous how they were able to polish this game. Because in America, especially after 9/11, there's been such glorification towards American military.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is good reason and to do that. Obviously, they're in service to the country and they're willing to risk their lives. But at the same time, everybody has a fallacy. Everyone always has. No one is free from wrong, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, and the game calls into question the ethics of, you know, someone's morality versus, you know, the order. You know, what's more important? Do you keep your own personal values above, you know, following your orders?
Right.
And this is actually going to be an analysis I'm going to be putting up next week. So make sure to stay tuned for that.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and this goes to the concept of orders versus, because you are a soldier. If you don't do the orders, you're messing up some grand plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we look at the German people. You know, these were atrocities from the outside view, but as soldiers, these are things you had to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what game have you been playing, Kenneth?
I've been playing Far Cry 3.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic game. I actually never knew Far Cry was an open world game. I never played Far Cry 1 and 2, and that was the same time Crysis came out, so I assume Crysis and Far Cry were like the same game or something. So I never got into either of those series. So just recently, I got Far Cry 3, and it runs pretty well on my computer. I'm surprised that I can run on ultra settings with the, you know, GTX 460. And so my first impression of the game was great. It has a lot of motivation in it. You start off as a bunch of like rich, adventurous white kids. Going off to like different islands. And what happens is you go skydiving and you land on some random island. And then as soon as they land, they get taken by slave traders. And you know, you escape and you have to find your friends. And as the game progresses, you do more and more pretty brutal things to survive in this world. And you can see the progression to the character as it becomes a scared white boy into, you know, a more brutal, savage kind of killer.
Yeah, now, the Far Cry series, the first one, it was somewhat open-ended, but it was largely levels with a lot of wide open terrain. So you had these objectives where you could, you know, do it from like any angle that you wanted. Far Cry 2 was the first one that had the open world. I think we were in the jungles of Africa, and you had to basically survive. You had malaria, so you had to keep taking pills.
Oh yeah, I heard about the malaria joke. Okay, got it. Now I understand.
And a lot of people didn't like Far Cry 2 because it was so, I guess, grounded in reality. Because of that, like, your gun would jam if you used it too much. You had to deal with, you know, constant patrols from enemies. So they kind of took away a lot of, like, that groundedness I heard for Far Cry 3.
No, there's still patrols, for sure. Gun doesn't jam, though, so that's good. And there is some ridiculous scenes in it. But for the most part, you know, the environment is very, very well detailed.
And it's kind of, there a lot of things to do, like, besides, like, the main mission?
Yes, there's a bunch of, like, side quests you can do. Like, there's supply drop-offs where you have to use the worst vehicles known to man to travel around terrain. There's so many times, by the way, talking about those vehicles, I think that's one of the worst parts of the game to me. They're so hard to control. There's a lot of times where I just, like, flip them off cliffs and just land in the river, where I destroy an entire bridge with it by accident. I'm like, all right, crossing the bridge. Oh, crap, I turn a little bit to the left. Oh, I go right through the bridge dividers, and I just fall off into a cliff or something. All the time with those stupid vehicles. But, oh, yeah, so there's, again, let me continue on. So there's supply drops. There's assassination missions where you have to pick off people and have to knife them to death. There is trials that you can do against your friends where you have to do certain activities, kill a certain amount of people. And there's just a lot of things to find, relics and stuff that are hidden underneath the sea. Because it's more than just, you know, it's a slave traders in an island. It's like an island that has its own history that you can tell. First of all, it has ancient civilization ruins, like, looks kind of like Mayan ruins, with, like, you know, the different areas with small temples or temples that were there now degrading. And they can find them underwater. You can find them on little islands. You can find them within different parts of the towns. So it has a great sense of exploration to it. And the island is gigantic. It's huge. And there's so many ways to get around in it. My favorite actually is the hang glider. Because you can go so far. So, and you can see the whole expanse of the world. And I think that's fantastic. And again, with the high fidelity of graphics, it really pulls you in. And the story itself is interesting. The voice acting is excellent too, up to snuff, very good. And so is the animation. So all of it is really fantastic experience so far, and probably one of my favorite shooters of this year.
And have you played Assassin's Creed 3 yet?
No, I haven't played. I only played a little bit of it, but I mostly watched Let's Play videos because I've been pretty busy. And I really, the reason I loved it so much is because I love U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And I love how they kind of integrated it all. And seeing like a recreation of Boston and New York back, you know, in the 1700s is really awesome.
Yeah, it definitely seems that Ubisoft has been making some really good open world games these days with the Assassin's Creed series and Far Cry.
It's definitely their year. They've been making a lot of great games. EA has been misstepping continuously. Well, Ubisoft has been putting out some stellar games. Come on, Warfighter?
Have you tried the multiplayer yet in Far Cry 3?
No. I heard the co-op is really bad. That's what I'm hearing. But then again, Spec Ops The Line, that co-op we did was miserable. Josh and I played the co-op for Spec Ops, And that was a terrible experience we had. Mm-hmm. It was just waves and waves of guys. We couldn't see, like, one or two hits would kill us, and we'd always run out of ammo. And when it ended, we were all like, oh, is that it? It never felt like we were achieving anything, but maybe that's part of it. They're like, all right, we had to put this in. Let's make it as terrible as possible so they never want to play it again.
And even the lead designer spoke out against it. He hated it. He thought it was just an unnecessary addition to the game. And I also have his quote in the upcoming analysis as well. So it's definitely interesting to see a developer basically, you know, tear apart his own game like that.
Well, just talking about that whole situation, I think that maybe discuss that in detail in a future post or future podcast as we get more and more guest podcasters in. Mm-hmm. That's actually done development and had to put multiplayer in their game.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about one of the posts we had on Game Wisdom this week. So I think we're going to talk about the Torchlight 2 versus Diablo 3 post, as both Kenneth and I are familiar with action RPGs.
Yep, this is the first time I've played both those games, so I have played Diablo 3 and I've played Torchlight 2.
And think we had a bit different opinion. I think I found Diablo 3 better, and you said that you prefer Torchlight?
Yes, I do prefer Torchlight. Maybe it's because my expectations for Diablo 3 was so high. Mm-hmm. And my issue was it was just that it was very short. And it just didn't have... It just felt so streamlined in comparison to D2. I think that's part of my issues with it. And their whole integration with... I mean, the whole shop thing kind of took away from the looking for the best items into getting enough money to buy the best items.
You were talking about the auction system, for those of you who aren't familiar.
Yep, there is an auction house where you can sell items for real money. So, I mean, Josh has actually gotten money from that system, right?
Yeah, but I basically paid for my Diablo 3 copy with it.
Well, that's... So, here you go. Mission accomplished. Free Diablo.
Yeah, Torchlight 2, in terms of design, is more familiar with the older style of action RPGs. When you level up, you get points to distribute to your character's attributes. You get a skill point. The trees are... I guess they're somewhat unique, but they're pretty generic compared to the skills you get in Diablo 3. And that's one area that I think Blizzard did succeed on, was how well they defined each class. And you could easily tell a witch doctor from a barbarian, for example.
Right.
They not only looked differently, but their skills were radically different. Witch doctors had a lot of area effect skills, they had their pets, they had curses, while barbarians had a lot of close range abilities, their mm-hmm. shouts, and it really basically gave the game a lot of interesting dynamics with how well you could build your character.
Yeah, but you also have a lot of customization with Torchlight 2, where you can use any weapon you want. As long as you reach the necessary stats or level, you can use anything.
Mm-hmm.
So as an Ember Mage, I was going around with a cannon shooting people. And it felt way better than using the Wimpy Staff.
And the big difference, and what makes Diablo 3 more restrictive, is that each class has what's called a primary attribute. And that attribute basically affects both their defense abilities and gives an attack bonus. So if you're a witch doctor whose primary attribute is intelligence, it doesn't matter what the weapon stats are unless it gives a bonus to intelligence. If it doesn't, the weapon will be just very inferior to something that may have a less damage output, but a higher bonus to intelligence.
Mm. And
I think that hurt Diablo 3 at launch, because it was so difficult to find good items that you were forced to use the auction house. I know a lot of people who just use that and just blaze right through the game.
Yeah, my first experience... It was a very jarring experience. My friends and I were all playing it before, and they would randomly have like every hour take a break to look at the auction house. We'd all just stop. We quit our game and go to the auction house. I'm like, this is not what I want to do.
And I think the one thing that I liked about Diablo 3 more than Torchlight was that the combat felt more refined in Diablo 3. It felt like you could actually control like the ebb and flow of what's going on. In Torchlight, we both were just, you know, running these like chaotic messes of special effects and guys dying. I know that I lost myself several times in the crowd. I couldn't see where my character was.
Yeah, you had that problem. I didn't as much for some reason, but I never really had an issue with the particle effects and everything. It's not as bad as, say, Guild Wars 2 with their special effects and their particle effects on their monsters. But I actually find it very satisfying killing monsters in Torchlight 2.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think the other thing that has solely a lot of people's opinion on Diablo 3 is that the game has been patched consistently since its release last May. They've added in more legendary items, they've upped a lot of the stats, they've made it easier to find things. But the big change is they now allow you to control how difficult the game is. You can tweak what's called the monster power of your game from a scale of 0 to 10. Basically, the higher you raise it, the higher the enemy stats are, but at the same time, you also get an increase to your chance of finding better loot. And this is a great way of, I guess, allowing the player to control how hard the game is.
I mean, that's fine all, but they're really grasping for straws because people felt betrayed and they left the game. And, you know, it's going to be hard to pull them back in there with alternatives like Torchlight 2, which is only $28, and we got it on sale for $10. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you get the same kind of experience. Again, I guess what in comparison to D3, and it's not really hard to do for Torchlight 2 being $20, is that its story wasn't very compelling to me.
Yeah.
Like, I just picked quests and did them. I didn't pick quests and feel like there was a good reason for them.
If the world wasn't really that defined compared to Diablo 3.
Exactly. But then again, Diablo 3 is built off D1 and D2, which has a huge amount of lore and history.
True.
So, I mean, there were a lot to compete against. But then again, you're getting a game for a fraction of the cost and getting the same kind of enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I've gotten high level, so I really don't know what the end game is like in that game.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I like Torchlight too. I like them both. I think they both did things great compared to the other, but I think they both also had some problems. Well, I know. Yep.
Oh, like the companion system. I like the companions in D3 better than Torchlight 2. Torchlight 2, the benefit is you can send them back to town. That's cool. But with Diablo 3, they actually had a little personality. Some history would leak out when you were to talk to them and stuff. It's great. I like that a lot.
Yep. Now, just to let everyone know about in Torchlight 2, you can customize your pets. You can give them some gear. There's pet-specific gear. And you can also give them spells. Like, besides the character's various skills, you can find basically spell pages throughout the world that you can either give them to yourself or give them to your pet, and these basically unlock new spells for you to use. So you could give your pet the ability to heal everyone. Or summon random minions, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, that sounds like a great dynamic that I have not tried yet.
Mm-hmm. One area that I was a little bit torn about is the loot system, because I think both Torchlight 2 and Diablo 3 had some missteps in terms of their loot design. In Torchlight, it felt that the loot was just so variable that it was hard to find the upgrades. So you never had that feeling of, wow, I just found this badass new sword, now look what I can do. While in Diablo 3, it was so limited in terms of what you could find and use because of the whole primary attribute lock,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, it would be like you would find this great weapon, you know, a super rare item, but oh no, it doesn't have your primary attribute. So just throw it away, basically.
No, no, you don't throw it away, you put it on the auction house.
And maybe sell it for, you know, 50 cents to $1 now.
Right. I mean, I wonder, looking at that, those numbers in history, I wonder how it's destroying people's lives right now. Cause I remember you being on Diablo 3 all the time, like, Josh, don't do this. You don't want to do this to yourself. Look at all the other games you could be playing right now. And instead you're sitting here farming the level 1 boss continuously.
And speaking about bosses, I think we both agree that the boss designs in Diablo 3 were better than in Torchlight, from what we played at least.
Yes, they're definitely more unique. I really love the butcher fight in comparison to the general Drell fight, which is rude and annoying, extremely annoying.
What did you think of the classes in Torchlight 2? Because I know you tried a lot more than I did.
I believe you tried just as many, actually. I only tried 3. Ember Mage, the Berserker, and the Engineer. Actually, what I like to do sometimes is I like to save up skill points and then spam them when I get to the spell I want. And sadly, when I was playing Engineer, I had it all ready to put into these, like, spider drones. And as soon as I got there, I only could put one level in it. I'm like, oh. Okay. And then I had like 17 points and then I put nothing in it. So I was just like weak throughout the entire game as the engineer. Just like hitting things with a hammer and barely doing any damage, but killing them eventually. So, yeah, I think that the difficulty isn't as high as Diablo 3. I noticed that, especially for the different classes, because I never really had a problem. And I think at D3, there's many chances where you could easily get surrounded and get killed, but I think there's a lot of saving graces to Torchlight 2. in terms of spells and the cooldowns for your mana potions and stuff, or your health potions.
What did you think about the skill systems of Torchlight 2 versus Diablo 3? Because they both use very different systems for that.
Right. Diablo 3 has a very streamlined system where you can pick whichever is good for a situation. I think that's really cool, where you can pick different loadouts, in a way, for different scenarios. And then Torchlight 2, you just have such a variety of spells. That's what I like about that one. I felt like there was a lot more variety of Torchlight 2 spells than there was the other one.
Well, I remember you were talking about how a lot of the skills were, like, locked behind, you know, level 44 or level 50.
Right. I mean, whenever I play these games, all I want are pets. That's all I want. I want pets. I want pets everywhere. And the engineer pet was, like, 44. Like, I'm talking about, like, the main one. And then there was another summon for the Ember Maid, which is, like, 44. I'm like, let's play all the way to that just to get that thing. Mm-hmm. You know what did the pets the best of these kind of games? Path of Exile.
Yeah.
That game, I could summon a huge amount of skeletons and a huge amount of zombies and just have, like, I don't know, a train of, like, 20 things behind me, just killing everything around me.
You have guys just running around killing stuff. For those of you who aren't familiar, Path of Exile is a free-to-play action RPG. It's been in beta for, I don't even know how long. It seems like it's been in there forever. Supposedly, I think they're shooting for open beta sometime in the first quarter of 2013.
Oh my god.
But it's definitely a very great game. They did a lot to, I think, mix up the formula. And I think it's a great middle ground between what Torchlight 2 has done and what Diablo 3 has done.
If you play Diablo 2, you'll love Path of Exile. It is very similar, not only in some of the playstyle, but in terms of the aesthetic, too.
Mm-hmm. Very dark, gothic,
right,
kind of.
Torchlight 2 went for the 100% stylized look, and then Diablo 3 went for a little bit more of a stylized look with a brighter palette.
Yeah.
Wow, Path of Exile, that is some grim gothic stuff right there, alright? Yeah. You're gonna feel it. You're gonna have flashbacks.
And I think Path of Exile is a really great character customization skill.
A huge tree. That thing is not a tree, it's
like a garden.
Yeah, exactly.
I think going back to Diablo 3, I think it was a good idea that you basically unlock all the skills, I believe, at level 30s when you get your last official unlock. But when you keep going to the cap, which is, I believe, at 60 now, you can unlock runes. And these runes are basically skill modifiers. When you put them on the skill, it basically changes it. It could, you know, give it more damage, lower its cost, or completely change the utility of the skill. Like one example for the Demon Hunter, he can put down these basically spike traps that do damage. One rune turns it into a sticky bomb that you can attach to an enemy that when you kill them, he explodes and does damage to all his friends nearby.
Alright. That's probably pretty useful for a ranged class.
Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot more, I guess, definition in terms of Diablo 3 characters and Torchlight. Did you find the characters were, I guess I would say generic in comparison.
Right. Exactly. The one's less memorable. So, I mean, there's a lot more customization, so it's a lot more of you into the game. But in terms of, like, memorability, definitely Diablo 3 for that one.
True. Alright. I think we're going to wrap it up now. So thanks again for everyone for listening in. Make sure to check out the post by Chris Beatris. We'll have a link to that at the bottom of this podcast.
Yeah, and take a look at his past games too. Pharaoh and Children of the Nile.
And Zeus as well. Both Pharaoh and Zeus, as I mentioned, they're available on Good Old Games. Children of the Nile you can find currently on Steam.
Special edition, whatever that means.
It comes with, I think, its expansion pack.
Ah.
And also, make sure to check out Chris Beatrice's company site, TiltedMill.com. And you can also look into their new game, Medieval Mayor.
Yeah, at first I thought it was Medical Mayor. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I'm a whole town made of doctors.
All right. And as always, we are continuing to look for guests, so make sure to send us those emails.
Yeah, and hey, anybody can make a submission post, so please contact us and, you know, tell us what you think or tell us advice on posts or come on for a post or come on for a podcast.
Yep, tell us how much we are idiots and don't know what we're talking about.
Don't worry, we're going to have a million if that happens. All right. All right, cool. So.
All right, so that will just about do it. Once again, I'm Josh Weiser.
And I'm Kenneth Ohm.
And you guys have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again next Friday.
Yeah, good night.
Good night.